Okay. My name is Wayne Smith, and I'm the professor for the University 100 course, and we're going over Religious Studies 255, the research and analysis paper on the principle of equal liberty, which is due Wednesday, October 13th, and this is on the board here, and all the students should have that in front of them. This paper looks very similar to what you're going to see in all of your courses. And so I think it's nice to be able to go through this. And to be honest with you, Professor Gilmore has actually put more information in here than I think you're going to get in some classes. Some classes might have more information, but my guess is more often than not, you'll have less information. Okay. First, at the top, general directions. Analyze a recent legal decision or related cluster of decisions in the U.S. as reported on that following blog, religiousclause.blogspot.com. So a related cluster of decisions matters. That's called stare decisis. Let the prior decision stand. So if it's about prayer in schools, if it's about employment law, if it's the case that's going on now, which is to the Supreme Court, which is, can somebody protest outside of a funeral, including a funeral for somebody who was killed in Iraq or Afghanistan? That has a history of related decisions. And in law, we have something called case precedent. So you can't just analyze one individual case. You kind of have to, that's important, but you analyze the sequence of cases that built up to that. And that's an important characteristic of that. So you have to spend time doing that. And it usually takes more time than you plan for. Okay? Utilize the judicial philosophies and the social facts discussed in the class in order to explain the background and significance of the issue. So part of the background is in the previous decisions. And significance means the importance of that particular decision or context. And you're going to have to explain that to individuals in a concise form, because there's a page limit. This paper should be 3 to 5 pages long, 12-point type, double-spaced, 1-inch margins. So she's giving you very specific instructions on what she'd like you to do. Can you close the door back there? Because it sounds like they're doing something out there. Thanks, Justin. Okay, 3 to 5 pages, so she's giving you a minimum and a maximum, which is good, rather than stating an exact point estimate or an exact number. 12-point type, so that's probably the default when you start Microsoft Word or something like that. Double-spaced, 1-inch margins. Pay attention to that. 1 inch or 1 1/4 is probably the default in your program. It varies by software. You have to pay attention to this. Double-spaced makes it easier to read, by the way. So that's one of the reasons we're doing that. Easier to read for you for correcting, but also easier to read for the instructor. Now do the math here for a second. She's probably teaching 4 classes. Say half of them have this paper due. They have 50 students in each class. That means that there's 100 students who are turning in, say, 4 pages. That's 400 pages that the professor has to read in about a week, maybe a little bit longer, but approximately a week, and grade, including, in some cases, English grammar, mechanics, syntax, language use, in addition to understanding content, depth of research, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to write for the reader, in this particular case, a professor who not only knows the material, but whose time is very short. I know your time is short too, but a professional's time is really, really short. So you don't want to waste any of that time. That's one of the reasons why we put rules like that there. And this will be true in all your classes. If it's not clear on the syllabus or the outline in some class, then ask the professor. Go to their office, check their materials if it's not clear, or say something like, we did it this way in this class. Would you like me to do it the same way or do it differently? The burden's on you to do that work. Okay, specific questions to address. Explain the principles of equal liberty. Also explain how this differs from the separation. I assume the separation model means separation of church and state, and why this is important. And I'm not an expert on equal liberty. This is not my content area of expertise, but it probably has to do with making sure that people's rights are not restricted and that everybody enjoys the right to pursue liberty even in the future when you don't know it and you can't be discriminated against again by race, class, gender, something along those lines, which were codified in 1964 more clearly. But this isn't my area of expertise, although I do have a book on it written by Professor John Rawls. I think it's called A Theory of Justice, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, so make sure you do your background research on that particular issue, and always make sure you answer the question. She specifically broke out the bullet point. Explain how the principles of equal liberty differ from the separation model and why that's important. So plan enough time in your writing so that you can write it, go through it, and then come back to it 6, 12, or better, 24 hours later, and say, and read it to yourself again. Did I answer the question, the specific question that the professor asked? Not just dump what I know, but did I ask the specific question? There's a couple of benefits to that. First of all, you'll please the professor, because then the professor doesn't have to do a lot of hard work. That's always a good thing. Two, as a professional, your time is going to be expensive eventually, too. And so you're paid to answer that question and nothing else, not just in a legal context, but in various areas as you get more and more specialized in your major. And there's a third product, which is an academic benefit, too. You're going to have to do this when you don't have time to review it, like when you have to do this project in class. You have to take the upper division writing proficiency exam. That's by taking that by hand, timed, in a room with no help. So it's good to be able to practice so that you can answer those questions when the pressure's really on and you don't have time to review it. Does that make sense? Describe the basic issues of the case at hand, providing context and background. Now, let me just talk a little bit about law for a moment, although this course is much more than law. When we analyze a case in law, we use something called the FIRAC method: facts, issues, rules, applications, conclusions. When we brief a case, we want to know what the material facts were, what the significant issues were, what was the rule, which means law, which means the statute. The First Amendment counts as a statute. First Amendment to the Constitution counts as a statute, among other things. And the case law. What's the case history, the stare decisis of that? That's the R. Then A means application. How was the law applied to the facts in that particular case? It could be different in other related cases. How was the law applied to that set of facts? And every case will have different sets of facts. So the application is, in a sense, the relationship between the facts and the law. And then conclusion. There's fancy legal names for it: a holding, a finding, a decision, an opinion, but it just means a final conclusion. Okay? Notice that of all those FIRAC issues, what is she asking you to do? Describe the basic issue of the case. The issue sometimes isn't stated exactly right. It's a little bit like a thesis statement. You have to pull it out. You have to draw it out from the reading. This is one of the reasons you can't just read something once. And you can't multitask. You need to read something more than once, and you need to focus, because if something is stated indirectly or there are multiple sub-issues, it's difficult to know what the main or primary issue is. Does everyone understand that? That's a hard topic. So she's asking you to focus on the central main issue in that particular case. There may have been some other peripheral issues that are not important. What's the central part? What's the kernel part? At the end of the day, what's going to be written up in the paper? What are other cases, subsequent cases, going to use to refer to this? What is the main idea that other cases are going to use in their decisions? Analyze the case using the principles of equal liberty. Does the decision of that particular case reflect the principles, or set a cluster of cases, reflect the principles of equal liberty? Why or why not, or how or so? She's being very clear. You don't just describe it. That's one of the things you do in high school. You make descriptive narratives of things. But in college, you go deeper than just the description. You're not just journalism majors. You analyze a particular case on the pathway to becoming an educated professional, and it's entirely possible that one or more of you in this room will actually go to law school. That's possible. In my juniors, I have a class of 40. I have three classes of 40. In each class, there are approximately four business law majors. And my guess is at least one, probably two of them are going to law school right here at Cal State Northridge. So you're not just doing what you did in the past, you're preparing for what you need to do in the future. And that includes deep analysis rather than just re-describing the facts that somebody else put somewhere else in a book or in a magazine or on a blog. If there's anything that you have a question on, ask me, okay? Okay, and then why or why not? You should always be, the hows are the procedural issues, how this came about, what are the relationships involved, and then the why is probably the most difficult question of all time. What were the causes that led to the effects? Were they incremental, or did they happen as a slam dunk all at one time? What was the intentionality, individual and collective intentionality involved in that particular time? That's tough. You can't just go back and ask people. You have to pull it. Sometimes you can, but not always. You have to pull it out. Okay? A friend of mine, Bill Cudahy, who also went to Claremont Graduate University, is the country's expert on the Fourth Amendment, the right against unreasonable searches and seizures. He wrote his PhD dissertation, 1,700 pages, on that particular topic. Okay? He can't just go back to the founders of the country and ask Thomas Jefferson, what were you really thinking when you wrote this piece, or James Madison, or somebody along those lines? So he has to pull those out by documents and a variety of other methods that history PhDs do. Okay, are there other judicial models being utilized here? If so, what are these? I'm not sure I understand this question correctly. I'm not sure what she means by judicial models. She probably means something related to the FIREC that I talked about when you're briefing the case, about the application of the law to the facts. That's probably what we mean. A model means a representation of reality. A representation of reality. So hopefully this phrase, judicial models, is used in her lecture or in the book. That's probably what she means. This isn't my area of expertise. But a model is a representation of something, and my guess is it's closely related to the application of the law to the facts. Okay. Let me ask the class, does this phrase judicial models ring any bells?
Yeah.
From class or reading, it does?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good, that's all we need to know. Okay, and then this last question I really think is fun. I mean, this is a great college question. Do you agree with the decision? Explain why or why not, right? You're not in high school anymore. You don't just have to describe what happened in the past or give a personal account of your own experience. Those are useful and interesting, but that's just the beginning of study. That's just the beginning of study. Do you agree with the decision? In college, we're doing research, we're doing study. People care about what you have to say. And every little thing, every little step that you break, every little step that you make, every breath that you take, this begins to sound like a Sting song from the Police. Okay? The Police is a rock group, was a rock group. Everything matters. Professors are interested in learning with you. Yes, I know, sometimes they're standing at the beginning of the class, but they want to learn from you. If you get a chance to see the movie A Beautiful Mind, starring Cameron Crowe, I can't remember who the star is of that movie. It's directed by Ron Howard. But that movie is about an undergraduate who eventually went on to graduate school and became very famous and won a Nobel Prize in economics. And one of the fundamental ideas in that movie, or at least an idea in that movie, is that the main idea that he came up with, which is a particular kind of equilibrium in supply and demand called game theory, we won't get into the details here, was formulated when he was an undergraduate, not a graduate student. The main ideas for that, undergraduate, exactly like you. Yes, he went to Princeton. Doesn't matter. The main ideas were formulated at that time. David Hume, one of the most important philosophers of the 17th century, was formulated many of his ideas as a teenager and then wrote them up, nearly all of them before he was 25 years old. We're still using his ideas today, including causation, among other things, and the relationships between cause and effect. So people are interested in your ideas passionately, even if the professors don't say it. And that's an incredible privilege. I always take the view, and I have these questions on my research papers too in my classes, and usually I phrase it slightly differently. I phrase it as, if you could meet the individuals involved in this situation, what would you ask them? Okay, that's one of the things. Sometimes you can't always do that. We have a special guest this year on campus, Reverend Lawson, who was one of the original founders of the Civil Rights Movement that marched along with Dr. Martin Luther King, among others. So you can actually ask him, even though he's probably in his late 70s or 80s now, maybe even older. You can actually ask him, what was Dr. King's thinking on this particular issue? You can probably ask the same thing of Reverend Jesse Jackson as well. But as it goes back further and further, you can't ask everybody. If you could ask the person, what would you ask that person? Interpret it in your own views and then explain it clearly. And professors are looking differently at different parts of the paper. When they see a question like this, this bullet point, they're not looking to see the exact same answer. You didn't collude. You didn't work together. This isn't a team-based assignment. Did she say anything about that? She just said work individually, or she didn't say anything about it. Mm-hmm. If she didn't say anything about it, it means it's an individual assignment. So she's not going to read two answers that are the same. Especially on problems in the humanities and the social sciences, even involving law, there's too many differences of opinion, too much philosophy going on for two people to have exactly the same ideas. That's rare. Move from content to details. Organization, always include a clear, succinct means unambiguous and concise. Clear, succinct, something that nobody has to read twice. They get it the first time. A clear, succinct introductory paragraph and thesis statement that spells out your argument and provides a roadmap for the content of your essay. Let's go through these words. Introductory paragraph and thesis statement. Thesis statement usually is the first sentence, not always, but usually. And it guides the reader as to what is the important theme in the paragraph. You know this? Why are you laughing? Okay, ignore him. Oh, well, just open the door and let him in. The door doesn't open? Push harder. The door has to open. That big bar on there is called a crash bar, by the way. This has nothing to do with the lecture. Crash bar because in the event of a fire, you can't have a handle. It takes too long to open, so people bump up against it when they're crashing against it, and then it opens the door. Okay? Just a little inside mechanical engineering here for you. Okay? So, thesis statement. Did you have a question about the thesis statement? That would be the transition sentence. The last sentence of the paragraph would be the transition, which would set you up for the next thesis statement. In the next paragraph. Do you understand? I can't hear you.
There's more than one thesis statement?
No, one thesis statement per paragraph. Okay. There might be a thesis idea for the whole paper.
Yeah.
Yes. So in a sense, you could think of the thesis statement as a sub-thesis statement of the main thesis of the paper. Okay? Does that make sense? One of the trends I'm seeing in my own students' writing is they tend to write fairly long paragraphs without breaking it up. That's not good. Okay? Don't write long paragraphs. That's called stream of consciousness writing. It means you haven't thought through about what are the key ideas, the key theses or subtheses, one thesis statement per paragraph. Because if you have a long paragraph, then you only need one thesis statement. But you don't write that way. Some academics do, some languages do, German in particular, writes very long sentences and very long paragraphs, but you don't tend to write that way. If a paragraph has more than four or five or six sentences in it, it's a possible candidate for what we call refactoring, rewriting that paragraph so that it's clear. Or else what you're doing inadvertently or deliberately, but hopefully not deliberately, inadvertently, you're confounding two thesis statements together. Not only is that unclear, it demonstrates that you personally haven't thought through the issue, which you may have. Don't leave the reader thinking that you haven't thought through the different issues involved. So break up your paragraphs. Okay, thesis statement, that, and she put it in italics. Look at how important that is to her. Introductory paragraph and thesis statement. She put it in italics. That means she's not seeing it occasionally in her other papers, and she doesn't want you to make the same mistake. This is just beautifully done. You're very lucky to have Professor Gilmore as a professor. I don't think most professors are going to go through the time to tell you all of these details, even though in University 100 it's kind of my job. That spells out your argument and provides a roadmap for the content of your essay. So let's talk about spells out your argument. That you can't put everything in one sentence, including the thesis sentence, but it sets in the mind the first part of the roadmap, the first milepost, that first signpost, if you will, about where you're going to speak next. Don't let people guess all the time. What is the main idea of your argument? Put it in that thesis statement so that it's clear. You could even argue, in the extreme case, if we take your paper and remove all the paragraphs and just keep the thesis statement, the thesis statements would probably map very carefully to an outline. Does that make sense? Yes? Does that make sense? And you should probably do an outline too. I highly recommend outlines, they're very useful. And then the outline, if you got the outline right, the outline should translate to the thesis statements, although you'll do more rewriting. Writing is really about rewriting. Well, I don't know how else to put it. I mean, writing is really draft writing. Just you get it out on the paper just so you can get something done and go have dinner or something like that. But the real thinking part is in the rewriting. That's not just true for authors like J.K. Rowling, who writes the Harry Potter books. That's true for our work as well. And by the way, she was on welfare for a little while. And now she's wealthier than the Queen of England, based on her writing and her thinking. People like her writing and like her thinking. Okay, and provides a roadmap for the context, of your essay. A roadmap, let's say you're giving a party. You don't want people to get lost to go to your house, right? So you give very clear directions, don't you? Especially to people who have never been there before, especially if they're bringing food, right? Or the root beer and the Coca-Colas and the stuff like that, right? You want them to get there, and you don't want them to be late, you don't want any problems. So you give them a roadmap, starting point, destination, or at least something closer to the destinations. People are starting at different points, in any particular areas and turns, contingencies that might show up. You provide a roadmap in your writing. All of this is what takes time. It takes hours and hours to do this well, and most people your age can't do it. They're not in college. They can't persevere. They can't do it. You can. Okay? And if you think through it well enough, you can write very, very well. Okay? And at CSUN, we have essays and national competitions and other things like that. And in certain areas, we can compete very well with other universities, including Berkeley, Stanford, and Princeton. Sometimes they don't have, I'm used to business competitions. Sometimes those colleges don't focus on business, they focus on other things. Okay. As well as a concluding paragraph that summarizes your essay and your key conclusions, right? Introduction, state where you're going to go, main body, flesh it all out, conclusion, restate the important points again. Okay, summarizes your essay. This is hard to do. I have an entire book in my office that's more than 1,000 pages long on how to summarize something. I bought it in graduate school, and I've only gotten through about the first 5 or 6 chapters. The math on summarization is beyond what I understand. Learning how to summarize something well, learning how to throw out what's in material so that the summary is what's important is a very, very hard problem, especially when you start to get data, numerical data. But it can be difficult in these cases that you're studying too. Very difficult. And your key conclusions. Make sure you want to leave the reader with those ideas. Writing must be clear and grammatically coherent, as well as descriptive and thorough. Let's do this sentence backwards here for a second. Descriptive and thorough. Okay? I sometimes call this the MECE principle. M-E-C-E, MECE. Mutually exclusive, collectively exhaustive. So by thorough, she means collectively exhaustive. Did you cover all the main points? At least in your view. Did you miss anything substantial or that the reader is going to think is substantial? And it's harder to write for a professor because a professor studied this particular area. And descriptive, if you categorize things, if you classified them, if you ordered them, if you sequenced them, if you numbered them, did you do it correctly? Mutually exclusive, collectively exhaustive. Okay, clear and grammatically coherent. We'll talk more about that when we get to the pet peeves here in a moment. Clear is a hard thing to do. Let's talk about grammatically coherent. Well, we already had a written in my particular class, and you probably saw that I took off even for some things that you might think are minor errors. There's a relationship between syntax and semantics. Syntax are the rules of writing, sometimes known as composition, and semantics is meaning. You have to get the syntax right because you don't want people to have an ambiguous or equivocal, which means multiple, meanings. You have to get that right. It also delays the reader's time, not just the professor, anybody who's reading anything. Remember that those lectures, those pictures I showed you up on the wall? The fast food company that said, get a free dessert here, D-E-S-E-R-T. And they meant to say dessert, which is D-E-S-S-E-R-T. Key areas in grammar that students have problems with, like we went over in class, subject-verb agreement. Because the verbs have more what we call morphology or inflections. You have to conjugate the verb. This is hard. So you have to know all of the different kinds of conjugations, which we'll talk about later on. Some of you speak multiple languages. Let's just pick Spanish for a moment. There are some things you do in Spanish you don't do in English. For example, you can say, ¿cuántos años tienes? How old are you? How many years do you have? But if it's an older person, or it's a formal context, if it's your grandma, you might say, ¿cuántos años tiene usted? So in Spanish, or Romance languages, which are called Italic languages in the Indo-European tradition, you have a formal you and an informal you. Notice in English we don't do that. Now, would it be the end of the world if you address a senior citizen informally? Probably not, but it'll feel a little awkward, at least in a language like Spanish. Okay? So grammar matters. It slows down the reader. It can change the formality. It can change the authority. And in some cases, it can change the meaning. And English has irregular verbs occasionally and some exceptions to rules. And there's a whole history behind how that happens, some of which we talked about in class before. So you have to do this, and some parts of computers are just not good enough to catch all the grammar errors. Dangling modifier, misplaced modifiers, too much passive voice rather than active voice, etc. Gender neutral pronouns, etc., etc. Okay, so this can be helpful to ask me ahead of time or have me look at the paper or something like that, or just go over it or go to the Learning Resource Center for this. The more you do that early on, you can fix the issues rather than doing it at the last minute. Okay, third bullet point. Demonstrate independent critical thought. She's underlining it, which means it's very important. She probably hasn't seen it as much as she'd like to in previous papers in previous years when she's taught this course. Demonstrate independent critical thought by making a critical analysis connections. These are the relationships. That is, explain what you think and why, providing evidence for your assertions. She's using very specific language. An assertion is something that you state. Evidence means something that can be supported. You can point to a piece of paper, a previous case. What did this professor say? What did the textbook say? Oh, I got this from my notes, etc., etc. Okay? And why? Independent critical thought. You could argue, actually, that's one of the main ideas of a college-educated person. And analytical connections are very, very difficult. At Christmas time, one of my favorite movies is A Miracle on 34th Street. I don't know if any of you have seen that movie. There's an older version and a newer version. And in the newer version of the movie, one of the lines in the movie is, the world is made up of things that you can see, but it's held together by things you can't see. This is probably just an adaptation of something a philosopher said many, many years ago. So the things you can't see are the analytical connections. That's why she put it here. You can't just touch the analytical connection. You have to describe it. You have to envision it. You have to conceptualize it. You have to think it through. And then you have to be clear about it in your writing. Okay? So after you do your writing, and before you're going to turn it in, you ask yourself, did I do this to the best of my ability? And talking it through with another student or with another professor can be very, very helpful. Use specific and relevant references to the text plural, so you have multiple texts, that support your analyses. Analyses is the plural of analysis. Using citations and quotations correctly and appropriately. So you've learned a little bit about how to cite something. If something's from the law, you're going to need a reference in section, or a table of authorities, which is what we call it in law. But it's a references section at the end of the paper that indicates what material you got this from. And I can see from most of your writings, the professor uses the full citation to the case. Okay? And you can look those up using a library database, which we haven't gone over in class, but the main library database for law is called LexisNexis. You can write that down and ask a question about it when we visit the library in a couple of weeks. LexisNexis. I think for the Wall Street Journal and the others, we used a different database, ABI Inform, if I'm not mistaken. Different databases contain material from different areas. Use quotations directly. If it's a direct quote, make sure you quote it. Don't use somebody else's work in any area. You can get expelled from the university, by the way, for this. Not can. It has happened. Okay. Not often, but occasionally. Get expelled from the university for using somebody else's material without citing it. It's called plagiarism. It's really a deeply unethical academic act. So don't do that. So use double quotes. You don't usually quote the whole thing. You quote the parts that you need, put periods around it, dot, ellipses around it. If it's going to be a long quote, use a block quote. Don't cram it in the paragraph. Block quote means you indent the right margin as well as the left margin. And put a citation reference after that and make sure people can find it in the references. I don't know if she'll look up each one of the citations, but in a class like I teach, I do. So I teach mostly juniors. This is a sophomore class. You'll be a junior after your sophomore. So prepare now, even though you're a freshman, you're taking a sophomore class, prepare now for what the juniors professors and the seniors professors are going to want to see in their class. I will check your references. Okay? Not so much to see if you're lying or anything like that. It has to do with me learning to see if you've used the material correctly, but also I want to learn from the reference. Okay? Every single assignment I give, I've been here 25 years, every single assignment I give partially with the expectation that I'm going to learn one new thing, at least one new thing, from my students' analytical connections and multiple analyses. Now, I don't say that. I probably should, actually, on my syllabus, but syllabi are getting so long, it's hard to do that. But I probably should have a button that says, I expect to learn from you on something I didn't know before. Just like John Nash did in A Beautiful Mind. Formulated the basic ideas of the Nash equilibrium, still taught today, 50 years later, in econ class.
He was a schizophrenic, right?
Pardon?
He was a schizophrenic,
yeah. Yeah, that's correct. And a good chunk of the movie is about his schizophrenia. Here in class, this particular class, we're not that interested in schizophrenia. We're interested in the fact that many of his ideas originated as an, excuse me, one of his key ideas originated as an undergraduate, okay? Not as a graduate student. I mean, most people win the Nobel many years later for work they've done later, and they already went to graduate school and were already top PhDs and things like that. Okay, it's a nice movie. It's a and I think it won Best Picture, if I'm not mistaken, when it came out. I'm not sure about that. Okay, last bullet. Proofread and spell check. One or two small errors. This is related to grammatically coherent. These are important words. If you don't know what this word means, go look them up, coherent. Proofread and spell check. One or two small errors may be acceptable, but sloppy essays riddled, which means has many of them, with misspellings and other errors will reduce your score. You've already seen how I grade at the junior level. I take off 10% for each error. Isn't that what I did? I don't even allow one or two errors. The reason for that is because it becomes what we call a slippery slope. One and two can become three and four just accidentally. You have to get it right. I mean, on that sign for the fast food, it was only dessert that was spelled incorrectly. Okay? It doesn't matter if it's only one or two. You aim for doing it correctly. Maybe perfection is too strong of a term, but you aim for doing it correctly in everything that you do, not just writing, in every piece of quality and related to research and thinking and allocating of your time. You have to do that. That's a requirement. That's a responsibility, being a college student. Okay, and she's being nice. She's being, one or two small errors are acceptable. She said maybe acceptable, right? Not even are acceptable, maybe acceptable. So don't push it with her. Don't say, well, you said one or two could be acceptable. And maybe. She might get upset after the 50th paper that has one or two errors in it. So you work on no errors, or at least few errors, or you just incrementally improve over time. So in a class with multiple papers, you have fewer errors over time. By the way, it's in those incremental differences that are the differences between a D student and a C student and a B student and an A student. It's an accretion of knowledge and how well you use it. It's an accumulation of avoidance of small little errors. So the small little errors never get a chance to build up to a big, large set of errors. Okay, reduce your grade. And let me just give you the business answer to this. If you can't communicate well, you can't think well, you can't write well, you can't speak well, it doesn't matter if you have the right answer, because nobody will listen. Either it's too hard to deal with you, or it takes too much time and effort to listen to what you have to say. And none of you fall into that category. That doesn't match my experience here at Cal State Northridge. None of you fall into that category. So you don't even want somebody to think that your idea doesn't matter. Your ideas do matter. Let me make sure that's clear. Even if you have the right content or the best content, but your writing is weak, it doesn't matter because no one will pay attention to you. And it doesn't matter what the technology is, a blog or a wiki. People will just ignore your blog. Okay, let's go over some of the grammar. And she put it, look at this, a fourth of the handout is devoted to this. This is how hard language is. And I wish I could make language easier, but it's not going to work that way. Professor's pet peeves. Peeves means annoy. Okay, it's actually comes from the word peevish. Okay, and pet means just something you own. So this is her own personal annoyances when she reads a paper. That's what this term means. Use basic punctuation and formatting correctly. In speech, we don't use punctuation, we use silence. Right? Full stop as a half stop, something like that. In punctuation, in writing, we don't have that, so we have to use punctuation. A full stop is a period. Half stop is something like a comma where you connect a main clause and a subordinate clause. You have to use that correctly. Quotation marks go on the outside of the period or the comma. For example, or that is, she put IE, which is the Latin for that is. This is a sentence, period and then quotes. Okay, and this may seem like a little thing, but she put it in there, and it's the first bullet, so she thinks it's important because it makes it easier for her to read and also She wants you to be successful in your future classes. All professors do. And she doesn't know. Maybe you're going to graduate school. Maybe you're going to law school. She just wants you to graduate as a junior or senior. She teaches juniors and seniors and probably a few graduate students. And she was a graduate student herself, just like me. So she wants you to be successful in the future, not just now. So she's trying to prepare you for that. If you write a paper on something, there may be a particular rule on it. She wants you to pay attention to the rules. Maybe you'll write a letter to the editor for the Los Angeles Times. You should be thinking about that anyway. What's something that really bugs you? You should write a letter to the editor of the paper. Not this is sort of a sentence with a period on the outside. She thinks that this is not the right way to do it. This is what we call APA style, American Psychological Association style. Also, the article chapter style should be placed in quotes. So if you quote something that's an article or chapter title, put it in quotes, just follow her rules. But book titles should be underlined. She wants you to follow the rules of citations. Or italicized, you can use either, but not placed in quotes. Follow her rules. This is a prescription. Whenever you're told what to do, that's a prescription, like you get a prescription for drugs if you're sick or something like that. But there's also proscription. Proscription means don't do that. Those are two different words. Prescription, proscription. See, those always go hand in hand. Right? Sometimes the doctor will say, don't eat that much salt. That's a proscription. Finally, quotes over four lines should be formatted as block quotes. I mentioned that before. Indented on both sides and single-spaced, even if the whole paper is double-spaced. If your paper cites just one source, the simplest way to do it is to put the appropriate page number in parentheses at the end of the sentence. Here's an example. Here is my quote with a page number. Citing multiple sources, citations may be either in MLA, which is short for Modern Language Association, or APA, American Psychological Association style, depending on your major. I do this the same way, too. Students can choose their format as long as they're consistent, because the professors know this. In your English class, you're probably learning the MLA citation format. Does that sound right? Why? Because the English teachers are the ones teaching the English classes generally, including Pan-African Studies and Chicano Studies and Asian American Studies, although they may not be. Depends. But since they're mostly English teachers teaching those classes, they use the English standards, the English major standards, which is standards from the Modern Language Association, as opposed to American Psychological Association is what we use in social sciences. I'm generally in a social science in management, even though I'm in the business school. Okay, and for our purposes at the lower levels of undergraduate work, it really doesn't matter which one we use. We just choose one and be consistent. And that'll be good enough for the professors, because the professors know most of this, because that's how we get promoted. So we have to write articles. We don't just have to teach and be good with you. We have to write articles on original research on ideas. And so we're very attuned to what these styles say. Style isn't really the right word. They're really formatting requirements. Style makes it appear as if it's more of a guideline. That's not really the case. Avoid sweeping generalizations. Okay, does everyone in the room know what these three words mean? What's a sweeping generalization? Nick?
All the points you bring together, basically that's it.
Okay, you're overgeneralizing from the facts of one particular case or the decisions of one case, or you're making generalizations. We used to call these in high school. When I was in high school, we called them glittering generalities. Because they shine a little bit. But shine doesn't mean they're shining for the right reason. That's a patina, which means an outside superficial edge. It's not really true on the inside. So let's say your house has been burglarized once, and it was a young woman on drugs who needed drug money. So a sweeping generalization might be all drug addicts who are young women burglarize houses to get money for drugs. You get the idea? Now, that statement might be true, but you don't cite it from your own anecdotal evidence. You'd have to get that from somewhere. My guess is on that particular issue, you'd have multiple sources with multiple opinions. That's my guess. So don't make sweeping generalizations. this can happen more in humanities and social sciences, because those are more philosophical topics, than it happens in the College of Business, where we're dealing more with numbers. There, this generalization is called an inference. You overgeneralize based on the relationship between the sample and the population. And part of that is just human behavior, and part of that is you're still learning these advanced methods to deal with numerical data and to deal with complex abstract narratives, which is what you do in this religious studies class. Avoid sweeping generalizations, and you'll hear these all the time. If you listen to talk radio and all this other, well, I'll use a technical term, crap on television. That's a technical term. Okay, you'll hear sweeping generalizations, all the Republicans this, Democrats this, all professors this, all men this, all Christians this, all Muslims do this. It's just, first of all, it's wrong, but more importantly, you be specific about what you mean. So she adjusts it here. In practice, this means you should recognize diversity within religious traditions. First of all, I'm here to tell you, and this is from my own experience, there's at least as much diversity within religions as there is among religions. And I have a little bit of experience of that being involved in the interfaith discussion in the Valley, not currently, but historically. Okay? There are groups that are Jews for Jesus. There's a complex, very complex set of assumptions and premises. Orthodox Jews are different than conservative. Conservative Jews are different than Reformed Jews. Lutherans and Methodists and Congregationalists and Unitarianists. Unitarianism, actually I don't know the word off the top of my head, do not all see the world of Christianity the same way. Certainly not compared to the Roman Catholic Church either. Okay? So don't make sweeping generalizations. This is a characteristic of an educated person. They tend not to do that. Okay? When I was growing up, we were usually taught that the newspaper was written for individuals at an eighth grade level. You're long past eighth grade. I don't know if that's still true. There are fewer and fewer people reading newspapers. Television, my guess, is probably aimed mostly at eighth grade or ninth grade, or else it wouldn't sell, right? They've got to aim it. They can't use too many fancy words that won't attract people. Okay? You could change your radio dial differently, and you could listen to NPR on the radio, and you could listen to PBS on TV, but that's a very small channel. There's other things on the TV, too. So don't write Christians do this, Muslims do that. It is usually preferable to state some Christians and many Muslims, etc., etc. Also, statements such as since the beginning of time or throughout history are generally poor form, overly used, and overly general. Let me go through this. Overly used, which means she's seen it too much. Not only in her students' writing, but when she looks at the news, when she reads things. So it's already overly used. You don't add to that. In my class, I prohibit the word like, usually. Because like comes from the Valley, like totally, like everything. It's overused. Even if it might be grammatically correct, so you don't use that. I'll give you another example from my own work. Whenever I see the word quality, I got to make sure that it's being used in the right context. Do you mean quality in the eyes of the person you're selling it to? Quality in the eyes of the engineering team? Quality in terms of side effects in the environment, things like that. And don't be overly general, because people can't draw conclusions from overly general. They can only draw conclusions from things that are clear and succinct. Okay? Use terms for religions correctly. This is hard because you're raised in one religion and you generally don't switch, or you switch later in life, or you don't switch multiple times. So use the terms for religions correctly. You know the terms in your own religion, but you might not know the terms in others, so you have to practice. What's the difference between Christian and Christianity? And the same is true for Buddhist, Buddhism, Jew, Muslim, Islam, Islamic. You have to use the right terms. Is it an adjective? Is it a noun? What kind of noun is it? Does it refer to the religion itself, or are you referring to the people? You have to practice on that. Check for agreement between plural nouns and verb forms. It's a grammar issue. Here's an example. She means example here, I think. Know the difference between belief, beliefs, that's singular, plural, believe, we're starting to get into a verb, and believes. Okay, believes is an inflection of believe. Inflection means change. How do we change it? Morphology is the larger term. How do we change it? How do we conjugate that verb? Okay, each language conjugates their verbs differently. Then last on the list, here's a common one. Know the difference between alter and alter, right? What's alter, A-L-T-A-R, what's that? Alter in a church, something you put something on, okay? And what's alter, A-L-T-E-R? Alter means change, yeah. Okay, so you gotta get these right. Why might, okay, we've already done this in class. Why might a word processor not catch this difference? Somebody other than Nikki. Why, we went over this in class. Why might a word processor not catch this difference? That's why she has to write it on this paper prompt. The technology, and it doesn't matter if it's a PC or Mac, it can be Google Docs, it can be anything. Modern, old, doesn't really matter. Alter is a real word with an A. A-L-T-A-R, alter with an E, A-L-T-E-R is a real word, okay? The word processor cannot know what you meant. It cannot know that. Word choice is very hard, and that's particularly true in English, which has an extraordinarily large language, vocabulary, excuse me. You have to do this yourself. There is no software that does this, at least none that I know of in the mainstream. Mainstream means available for all of us to use relatively inexpensively. Here's another common one, there and there, T-H-E-R-E and T-H-E-I-R. I see this all the time. You might as well put in there, T-H-Y apostrophe R-E, just a contraction of they are. These are very complicated. In English they might sound the same, but you write them differently. One of the reasons I think students are making these errors is because they're listening to things more often with the iPod and things like that, mobile tech, portable music devices, and not reading as much. When you read, you can see the difference between those two. There and your, there's the UR and the YOR. It and its, there's an irregular verb there, the two and apart, et cetera, et cetera. These are just examples. You have to be the real issue is to be cognitive of the issue. Okay, are there any questions on that particular issue? On anything on this handout. You're going to be doing the same thing for the next 4 years. And then what happens when you get to graduate school? Graduate school, they're less interested in the facts because they know you know them already. They're more interested in what you have to say. In undergraduate, we're interested in you making sure you understand the context and then a little bit in what you have to say, growing over time. But in graduate school, it switches around. People are more interested in what you have to say. That's a ways off. But you'll see as you go through your freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, increasingly people are interested. Even very well-known professors, I'm not including myself in that category, well-known professors are interested in what you have to bring to the table. Question is, Nikki's question is, do you need to analyze one case or a series of cases? Okay, and I'm looking here at the first bullet and it says analyze a recent legal decision or a related cluster of decisions. In my own mind, these two are the same thing. You can't analyze a recent decision unless you understand the other related decisions on the topic, to be honest with you. I don't think that those are separable. She probably just put the or in there so that depending on what the case is about, it limits how far back you have to go to understand the context. Do you understand? Okay, good question. And remember, I'm not the professor of the class, so if it's not clear, you have to ask the professor, okay? And that's the kind of question you might want to use in the office hours rather than via email, unless you develop a relationship with the professor and she knows you and you know her, and then maybe you can use email. Good question. Good question. Other questions?